This WebmasterRadio.fm program is made possible in part by the following.
Today's forecast calls for 6 to 12 inches, and temperatures will only be in the teens overnight, so bundle up and...
Imagine, you're planning your end-of-year reports, planning for next year. What are you going to do to monetize more in 2011?
We're going to have clear and sunny skies with a perfect day of weather for everyone coming to AFCON 2010.
Warm up your marketing strategies this December in our winter oasis for affiliate marketers. AFCON 2010 Florida, December 8th through 10th at the Fairmont Turnberry Isle Resort in Aventura, Florida. Sign up now at AFCON2010.com. That's AFFCON2010.com.
The opinions expressed on this WebmasterRadio.fm program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of WebmasterRadio.fm. Any rebroadcast or retransmission of this program without the express written consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.
Feeling better? Looking better? Making life better? It's Life Tips. We'll explore the latest innovations, introduce you to the latest products, and bring you the tips from experts and environmental pioneers to help you lead a better life. Life tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, wiser. Here are your hosts.
Welcome back to the Life Tips Show, everyone. Happy to be here. I'm here with Marisa McLaren. Welcome, Marisa.
Thank you.
You are the owner and webmaster of the website foodinjars.com, a fabulous site that I've been browsing and poking around on. Happy to have you on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about your site and your mission in life?
Absolutely. Well, my site, Food in Jars, is a food blog, essentially, devoted to teaching people how to do things like canning, preserving, baking, making things that they would typically buy at the grocery store and doing it themselves, making from scratch. And my mission is just to teach people to can, to get them reconnected with a skill that used to be sort of assumed. People used to know how to do this stuff, to preserve food and put it up for another season, and it's just one of those things that we've lost along the way.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you the first question out of the gate, which is a paranoia I have with regards to canning things and pickling things. Is there loss of nutritional value through that process if done properly?
There is some loss of nutritional value, but cooking also makes us lose some nutritional value. So, if we all could handle a raw food diet, that's probably the best way to go. But I feel like it's the trade-off is worth it in terms of knowing what's in your food, having a connection to where it came from, because typically when you're canning, it's something that you've either grown yourself or you buy from a farmer you know, or you've picked it yourself, so there's a deeper connection, and I feel like that makes up for any loss in nutrients.
You have quite a few comments on most all of your posts. Just incredible following your site. Congratulations for that. What do you attribute this sort of fanatical approach to reading your blog posts and commenting? Tell us about your fans and how you've helped develop them over the years.
Okay. Well, I think, a big part of it is luck. I know that that's probably not the most helpful comment, but I think I was at the right place at the right time. I started the site in, it was March of 2009, yes, and there wasn't really anybody else writing a site dedicated to canning and preserving at that time. Mm. A bunch sprung up right about that same moment, but I was one of the first ones in, so I feel like that gave me the opportunity to sort of become one of the primary voices in that area. I did look to see if there was anyone in that area before I started. Before I started Food in Jars, I was the editor of Slash Food, which is AOL's food blog, and so I had spent about 2.5 years participating in food blogging and knowing what was happening in the area, so I had a fairly good handle on what existed, what was popular, where the sort of holes were, And that was a large part of why I started Food in Jars. Now, I also just happen to be very interested in the subject, and so I think that's the other part of why people come to me, is that you can tell from reading that I am passionate about this and that I am very interested and engaged in food preservation, on making things from scratch, on being more aware of the seasons and trying to eat within the rhythm of seasons. And I live in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, so, you know, we're sort of limited in terms of what comes, what's available at certain times of the year. So being active in preserving the peaches and the strawberries is a way to extend that harvest, and that was very important to me. So, you know, it was a twofold thing of being aware of what was happening in the marketplace and finding a niche for myself, and also happening to be very passionate about that niche.
Could you tell us a little bit about the market size? How many canners? Is that a word? I don't know.
It is a word.
How many canners are there out there?
I don't really know how many canners there are. I can tell you that the Ball Corporation, which the people who make all the canning jars, say that their sales were up 40% this year over last year, and I think
wow.
they were up something similar to that last year as well. So right now, the market is booming, and I would say 75% of my readers are people who had just started this year, who haven't even canned yet, who just like the idea of it and are contemplating dipping their toe into it but haven't gotten to it yet.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that my traffic this summer, at my peak, I got nearly 80,000 unique hits in a month, which translated to about 165,000 page views, which was my biggest traffic period ever, and felt fairly significant for something as sort of niche as canning.
Wow, that's remarkable. What do you attribute that fast growth to? Just organic success, and obviously you're probably not paying for traffic to your site.
No, everything that comes to me is organic. I have a Facebook page that has been fairly instrumental in helping me drive people to me, but the growth on that page has been completely organic as well. I haven't paid for any Facebook ads, and that page has nearly 4,500 people following it. And so I try to post every new post I write. I'll publish it there and to my personal Twitter account and to the Food in Jars Twitter account, in the hopes of driving some traffic to me as well. And it's been very successful.
Really fantastic. Now, I noticed only really a fairly understated Amazon, you know, a few products you've picked up on Amazon through an affiliate program, and you know, it looks like Google's running some ads, but it looks like you're not heavily into the monetization of the site, strangely
no.
enough. You know, you're doing this for love and passion, obviously, which is really fantastic. I'm sure all your readers really appreciate that. But just tell us a little bit about, you know, do you have any plans to try to monetize more or actually make a living doing this? Is that something you've thought of?
It is, and I would really like to. It's just been a matter of time. I also have a full-time job in addition to running this website, and so it's really been the fact that there are only so many hours in the day, and I just haven't had the time to do it. And part of it is I want to do it well. When I do eventually monetize, I want to ensure that I do it in a way that feels honest and sort of holistic to the canning ethos that I have been chasing and working on. You know, I don't want to just smack a bunch of blog ads up there and say, all right, you know, here you go. I'd really prefer to do something along the lines of a, you know, sponsorship spotlight where, you know, I have a couple of carefully chosen sponsors that I highlight each month. And to put something like that together requires a lot more energy and effort. And I'm certainly willing to put that effort in. I just haven't had the time. And so I haven't really monetized the site well. And that's why. I do teach classes, and I promote them on the site.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a really effective way of monetization. Obviously, that is not a passive form of income and requires a lot of energy and effort, but it's really worth it. I really enjoy teaching the classes, and everybody who comes to them leaves at least they tell me, that they leave feeling much more excited and comfortable with the concept of canning.
Has the site helped your participation in subscription to your class?
Yes, I don't think that I'd really be able to suck classes out the way I have without the website. You know, it is the site and the Facebook page are my primary means of promoting the classes. I don't, you know, beat the bushes in any other way. So it's been instrumental.
Tell us about the classes and how that's tying in.
Well, so I'm teaching people to can on the website, and the classes are essentially an opportunity to spend a couple hours with me doing the same thing. And the great thing about the classes, you know, I focus on a recipe, whether it's strawberry rhubarb jam or applesauce or dill pickles. You know, I'll set up 4 or 5 classes per season, and each one will focus in on a different recipe, and I limit the classes to 10 to 12 people. And people sign up. They cost $45 a seat. Everybody gets to take home a jar of whatever we've made in the class that day, as well as the recipe. And for the people who really just need to see it done, it's a great opportunity for them to be guided through the process. And I answer every question people have before they leave the class. I don't want anyone to leave without and feel like they still have questions. And I give everybody my email address so they can email me afterwards if they have a question that comes up or an issue. So it's a very sort of service-oriented experience. And it has been really terrific. And, you know, that doesn't necessarily build traffic, but it certainly builds goodwill and creates sort of boosters, fans for me, that I think translate in the long run into sort of more love for the blog.
I have to ask if you've thought about taking the class online.
I have. It's something I'd really like to do. In fact, my husband and I used to make an online cooking show before I started this website called Fork You. And so we have about 55 episodes that we made, and I really enjoyed that process and enjoyed the different quality of interaction you get with people when you make a video. And it's in the plans. Again, it's just been a matter of time. My husband is the video editor amongst us, and he's a tech writer and has been writing a series of books about blogging platforms over the last couple of years, and so just hasn't had the time.
Interesting. Well, you're so well-spoken. I want to just thank you for being on the show. Let's take a bit of a break here, and we'll come back after a few minutes and just ask a few more questions for you. Can't wait to learn more. Back in a jiffy, everybody.
Life Tips will be right back after this short break. How do you choose the right affiliate network to partner with? The answer is simple. MarketHealth.com, where health and wealth connect. Established in 1998, the MarketHealth.com affiliate network allows you to market and promote the world's leading health and beauty offers on the net. Start making recurring income and the highest payouts in our industry. Choose from over 50 of the hottest selling offers, ranging from herbal supplements, skincare, vitamins, beauty products, weight loss, and much more. Sign up for free at MarketHealth.com and start making money today.
Hey, this is Danny Sullivan to talk to you about Bruce Clay Incorporated. They've made Inc. Magazine's list of growing private businesses and have exhibited and sponsored at my conferences since the very beginning. You've seen their search engine relationship chart or you've read their SEO code of ethics, so you know they're SEO experts. But did you know they can help you with PPC, web analytics, web design, marketing strategy, promotion, and branding? Yep, get everything you need for success in the online marketplace. You can check it out from the professionals at Bruce Clay Incorporated. For over 10 years with offices worldwide, they've got the answers you need. Check them out today at BruceClay.com.
What is this? Why is my website not ranking higher?
Well, sounds like you could use a link building report from SEOFox.com.
What's that?
You can't rank without good backlinks. And SEOFox.com's link building report lets you enter domains and compare their backlinks. It gives a detailed report that shows you why each domain ranks where it does, and it reduces the time it takes to find more links. With SEOFox.com's link building report, you can find more links, use their search marketing services to find more links, or better yet, they could even build your own backlinks.
So you think you're pretty sly with that SEO Fox link building report?
Sly like a fox.
Get your link building report today at SEOFox.com. That's SEOFox.com.
CEO Coach.
Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, or on demand anytime inside the Culture and Business Channel, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And now back to Life Tips. Making your life smarter, better, faster, and wiser. Here are your hosts.
Welcome back, Marisa.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, thanks for making the world a better place, one can at a time for us. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about the complexity of canning in general before. I've got some other challenging questions for you, but how hard of a sport is this to get into?
You know, it's actually far easier than it gets credit for. People typically have the idea that you have to buy a ton of equipment to get started canning, and honestly, you don't. There are just a few pieces you need, and most of the time, if you have a fairly well-equipped kitchen, you'll have them already. One would be a cooking pot. It needs to be either stainless steel or enamel-lined. You just want something that is non-reactive, because most everything you're going to be canning at this stage is going to be a high-acid food, which means that if there's a lot of acid in it, it will react with pots like aluminum and create a metallic flavor in your finished product. So you always want to make sure to use a non-reactive pot. The second thing you need is a pot to do the processing in, and that can be a stock pot. You just need something that's deep. So like if you're someone who does a lot of crab steaming or lobster cooking, you know, you can use those big old like speckled enamel pots. So you just need a pot, one pot to cook in, another pot that's deep enough to hold the jars and have about an inch of water above them. Beyond that, you need a wooden spoon. Most people have that in their kitchen. Knives, cutting boards, things like that. It helps to have a wide mouth funnel, and that is a sort of a specialized piece of equipment, and a jar lifter, which is also kind of specialized. But you can always use tongs. The wide mouth funnel and the jar lifter just make things a little bit easier. But that's really it. Like, that's the extent of the equipment, and then your jars. And most grocery stores these days have a small canning section, or hardware stores. I've seen it at Target. I know that, like, this summer Lowe's was carrying jars, so they can be purchased at a variety of places. And that's it. And I mentioned high acid a minute ago. There's kind of two schools of canning. There's low acid and high acid. High acid is most of your fruits, pickles, chutneys, things like that. Low acid are vegetables that aren't pickled, and meat, and sort of squashes and things like that. And so for the low acid foods, you're going to need a pressure canner. So those aren't really foods for beginners, but fruits, pickles, things like that are super easy. And I've got a number of recipes on my site. I can also walk you through like the basic steps of canning if you'd like.
There's a lot we could do. We have maybe 5 or 10 more minutes, but one of the things I wanted to ask you about, just from a practical perspective, and that, by the way, yeah, it might take an hour and a half, so we're with all of your vast knowledge, and we would want it all, so I think we just all need to sign up for your online class, basically, when that's ready for us. We'll get back on the air and announce that to any guests when that happens. What I wanted to ask you about is a classic problem. First of all, I love food, and I love cooking, and I have not entered the world of canning and preservation, but I can't wait to do that, partly because I'm hoping to garden soon as well and you know, do make the classic mistakes of planting, you know, 30 tomato plants and not knowing what to do with all these tomatoes because they probably all grow with all the wonderful fish oils and other things that my gardening friends have turned me on to, so I'll be faced with that challenge and that problem. But my question was regarding, you know, either canned products or preserved, you know, products in the famous glass bottles, and knowing when there might be a problem. I have a lot of canned products on my shelf that I've picked up in farmers markets over the years, and I can't even remember when I picked some of these up, but I just love supporting local farmers, so my eyes and, you know, are a little bit bigger than my desire to consume all of this. When do I know there's a problem, and how can I check for things?
Well, typically, if there's a problem in the jar, and this is, again, with those high-acid foods, which are often what you're buying at farmers markets. You're buying like ketchups or jams or things like that, right? Like, okay.
Tamales.
Yeah.
So pickles.
If there's a problem in the jar, it'll typically be some sort of bacterial growth or yeast growth, and when those things grow, they off-gas, and eventually they will break the seal on the jar. And so you should never, ever eat a jar where the seal is broken, where if it just comes, the lid comes off easily, if there's no sort of suction sound when you open it. And obviously you should never eat something that's been home canned if, when you look at it, it looks off. You know, maybe it's a funky color or it's growing something. Obviously, that's a sign that you shouldn't eat it. But as long as the people who canned it know what they're doing and they make sure things are sterilized, they follow the processing step, which is that boiling the filled jars in your large stock pot or something like that, it should be safe. I do steer, there are certain things I do steer away from when buying other people's home canned products. And those things are the meat products, soup. Living here in Philadelphia, I'm fairly close to Lancaster County, and so there's a lot of the Amish home canned goods for sale in my area. And I happily buy their jams or preserved fruits or pickles. I don't buy their soups necessarily or the canned meats because not knowing what the process was in order to put those up, it makes me a little nervous. But as far as the high acid things go, you should always be able to tell. Because here's the secret. Botulism, which is the big scary thing we all know about with canning, botulism doesn't grow in high acid environments. So you will never kill anyone with a jam or a pickle or a chutney or something like that. So you're not going to die from jams or pickles.
Got it. That's actually a great tip and a great recommendation. Thanks for that. Maybe that's where I should start, particularly when I start giving it out to friends if it's something I might grow. What are the most popular fruits, vegetables, meats with regards to overall market share? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, in terms of like what people are looking to do, tomatoes are the biggest, I believe, because tomatoes are fairly easy to grow. And so I get a lot of questions about canning tomatoes. I posted a tomato jam recipe this year that was incredibly popular. People, so many people made that jam and raved about it. And I admit it's a good jam recipe, and I can't take credit for it. It belonged to a friend of mine. So tomatoes are huge. People are always looking for pickles. And one of the exciting things about pickles is when you have your garden surplus, you can pickle just about anything. So people love that. They're like, I have leftover snap peas or string beans. What do? Pickle them. And so that's really been a popular thing, too, is just sort of the general, hey, you can use this pickling brine on just about anything.
That's interesting. Let's talk about the pickling process, and I'm particularly interested with pickling, say, fiddleheads, which happen to be my absolute favorite plant. I believe it's a plant, not a vegetable. I have to check on that. You might know the answer to that.
You know, I don't know for sure. I think you're right, though. I think it might be a plant and not a vegetable.
I know it's a fern eventually, which is probably a plant when it grows up. But tell us about pickling and how complex it is, how easy it is.
Pickling is very easy. It's essentially creating a brine, which is typically vinegar. So either a white vinegar or an apple cider vinegar, diluted never more than by half. So any recipe you see that calls for you to water your vinegar down by more than, so it would be like a 1-to-1. You don't want to follow that recipe. But any recipe that's 1-to-1 or has more vinegar than that is perfectly safe. And essentially what you do is you put some spices in a jar. You pack your jar with whatever vegetable you're planning on pickling. If you do a fiddlehead, you'd probably want to blanch it first. Just give it a quick cooking. And then you pack them into a jar, and you pour your brine over it. And a brine is typically that vinegar, water, and salt. You heat that up so the salt dissolves, and then you put a lid on it and process it. And the processing is just boiling those jars in your big stock pot for anywhere from 5 to 20 minutes, depending on what you're pickling and what the recipe is. Typically, with pickles, it's at the shorter end of the time. And that's it.
What is boiling the jars accomplishing from a chemical perspective and a preservation perspective?
It does two things. First, it ensures that the heat of the boiling water penetrates the jar all the way to the center to kill anything that might have floated down into the jar. So bacteria, yeast, any sort of anything that you don't want to be in there, anything that could spoil the jar. And then it also makes sure that there's enough heat in the jar so that when you take the jar out of the water, the oxygen escaping from the jar will, the heat and the oxygen escape, and that creates that airtight seal. So as the heat escapes, it pulls the oxygen, and that pulls that lid down on the jar and creates the airtight seal that you need for preservation.
And if you were to undercook something or overcook something, what would happen?
Well, if you overcook something, it just won't taste very good. If you undercook it, you might not get a seal, which is why it's always important for home canners to check their seals after they take the jars out of the canner. And essentially, it's with most conventional canning jars, you can tell by looking at them because the lids will go sort of concave. But once the jars are cool, you take the rings off, which are the screw band, you remove that, and then you just check to see how tight the lid is sealed. And as long as it doesn't move at all, your seal is fine. And so really, as long as you get a good enough seal, there's not anything, there's no undercooking, essentially.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about a favorite topic and subject on the Life Tip Show, alcohol. Have you seen any interesting experimentations, and can you preserve things with alcohol? And I'm thinking here specifically about some of the rage of, infused vodkas, for example, pineapple. There's just a whole flock of infused. But can alcohol be a preservative, and can you use it for either canning or pickling or whatever you might suggest?
Yeah, absolutely. Alcohol is a very popular way to preserve fruits. There's a thing called bachelor's jam or rum puff. It's essentially, over the course of a summer, you take a crock or a jar and you fill it with fruit, or you create layers of fruit and you pour alcohol on top of it. And then as the next thing comes into season, you add a layer of that and pour more alcohol. And so there are histories of different cultures doing this to preserve fruit. And typically it's saved for the holiday season, and so you drink the alcohol and eat the fruit around Christmas or New Year. There, you can also do more sort of single fruit-infused alcohols. I have a good friend who did a rhubarb Everclear this year, and she essentially had a bunch of Everclear. She steeped the chopped-up rhubarb in it, and after something like 2 months, took the rhubarb pulp out, what was left of it, and sweetened it a tiny bit, and has this amazing sort of rhubarb liqueur that, from what I hear, is pretty phenomenal. I have tasted, a friend did a vodka infused with strawberries, and I got a taste of it last year. She lives out in Oregon, where I grew up, and my sister named it Jam Boozy, because it was like jam, only boozy. It was good. So the sky's sort of the limit in terms of what you can do with alcohol and fruit.
Could you tell us a little bit about the deterioration process of the fruit itself in the alcohol? Can you over-infuse, and can it get dangerous? Is there a deterioration of the product itself within the alcohol that we should know something about?
Well, the longer you leave the fruit in the alcohol, the more the fruit will transfer its essence to the alcohol. Uh-huh. So it really depends on whether you just want fruit with a taste of alcohol, or if you want to encourage the fruit to give its all to the alcohol.
Uh-huh.
So it won't go bad. There's not a point at which it can get dangerous. You obviously want to make sure you keep lids on it in order to keep any sort of external crud from getting in the jar, but really, it's not going to. There's no danger to it. Uh-huh. You know, alcohol is one of the most potent preservatives there is.
Uh-huh.
So, you can really do a whole variety of things. It's just up to you whether you want, like, for instance, with my friend's rhubarb liqueur, she strained all the fruit out of it and threw it away. It had given its all to that alcohol, and so there wasn't any sort of virtue left in the fruit, whereas recently I tried some apple brandy, which was just someone had chopped up a bunch of apples, put them in a jar, and poured brandy over them, and the fruit was meant to be eaten. I mean, the brandy was meant to be consumed as well, but the goal was to just let it sit for a few weeks so that both items were consumable, whereas if you had let the apple sit in that brandy for many months, eventually you would strain out the apple and throw it away and just consume the brandy.
Mm-hmm. And there will, of course, be a question from somebody. I won't imagine who it is, but are you losing any alcohol content within the infusion process?
You lose a bit, but particularly because you don't necessarily want to really squeeze or press the fruit. I mean, you do a little squeeze, but if you kind of push it around too much, you start leaving pulp and fruit matter behind. Mm-hmm. So you do lose a little bit, but what you gain in flavor is pretty nice, and so I think it's a worthy trade-off.
Indeed. How can people get a hold of you? It's been such a great pleasure, by the way. Thank you for being on the show, but I want people to be able to reach out to you in any way, shape, or form you'd like.
Well, the easiest way for people to get a hold of me is through email. My email address is foodinjars@gmail.com, or they can reach me on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is foodinjars as well.
Before we dash off, I know you had a couple of tips that you had sent in, and I wanted you to just fire through them at a nice pace. I know we probably covered a few of them, but do you have them in front of me, or do you want me to read them to you? Or
I have them. I can read them.
Great. Fabulous.
All right.
Even better.
So these are some specific to canning and some more general about spending time in the kitchen. So they are: always read any recipe all the way through before starting to cook. A good, sturdy wooden spoon can do just about anything. When prepping jars for canning, make sure to clean a few more than you think you need. Make sure to start any cooking project with a clean, empty sink. And when preserving fruits or vegetables, they don't have to be cosmetically beautiful, but they should always be as fresh as you can manage. That's it.
Great tips. And here's a question for you on one of your tips. How many wooden spoons do you own?
Oh, my God, I have at least 20. It's sort of obscene. But I love them.
I had this feeling that you might be a person that was almost a wooden spoon collector.
I am. I am. It's kind of sad, but I have a bunch, and I just adore them all.
You know, they seem to almost carry flavor to them, in my opinion. I feel the same way about wooden spoons. They have a magical quality, I'm convinced.
It's true. It's true. There's something kind of, yeah, they take on whatever you make with them and eventually just develop great character.
Well, we've so enjoyed having you on the show. Thanks again for being here.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The site is Food in Jars. Our guest was just fabulous. Thanks again for listening, everyone. We'll see you next week on the Life Tips Show, and look forward to the next. Until then, I hope your life's a little smarter, better, faster, wiser, and more preserved. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week.